The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, February 23, 2018. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal, the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Aviva Chomsky, Undocumented, How Immigration Became Illegal. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is our final pre-recorded show of the week. We will be back live on Monday. Of course, you will be getting a mat pick for members on this show. Fascinating interview, if I do say so myself, with Avi Chomsky, at a time where, you know, the assault on immigration is not just illegal immigration or undocumented immigration, but also immigration, period. The idea that we would have new people and a diverse mix of people in this country is under assault by Donald Trump. And because it provides him, I think, in his mind, some type of electoral benefit. But the concept of immigration, the concept of illegal, has changed through the years. And Avi Chomsky takes us through that. Just want to remind you that this show relies on your membership to survive. We cannot do this show day in, day out, but for those people who become members, support the show. It's $10 a month, comes out to $2.50 a week. That is 50 cents a free show. This week, we did four free shows. Our members got a fifth show. If you're not a member, you missed an interview I did with Steve Gilpin. He was a professor at Trump University. I guess technically, professor is not, I mean, I looked this up. Professor is not, you don't need a PhD or an advanced degree to be a professor. You don't even need to be necessarily in an accredited school.
Just get up there and profess.
You just need to be able to profess. I don't know how I thought about the guy, to be honest with you. But if you join today, you can go back and you can check the archives. You have access not just to that, but over the past 7 years. And then, of course, you also get the deep archive shows that we put on weeks like this. So, but for 50 cents a day, two quarters, you support the free show. This week we had Daniel Ellsberg. I guess a week ago we had Levitsky and Zyblad on how democracies die. Shane Burley talking about fascism and giving us a really succinct taxonomy of the right. Sam Rosenfeld talking about the history of polarization in this country. These are the type of things that we do day in, day out. And then as a way of saying thank you for becoming a member, we give you another hour and a half of material. It's lighter stuff. Sometimes we get phone calls from folks who are like dreamers, or we get phone calls from immigration lawyers or people who are on the ground who tell us about different races that are taking place across the country, people who talk about different protests. We take calls, we get IMs, and then we also, you know, mock a lot of people on the right and then Fox News, and we have clips and sometimes a few laughs. And sometimes feelings get hurt. That's basically, that's a day in the life of the Majority Report. You can be a part of that. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Support this program. We definitely always need your help. All right, sit back, quick break, and then when we come back, Avi Chomsky on Undocumented, How Immigration Became Illegal. We will be back live Monday, just a couple days from now. Or depending on when you're listening it, maybe not a couple of days from now. Maybe just half a day. Maybe a couple of hours. All right, see you then. We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Avi Chomsky. She is a professor of history at Salem State University, author of Undocumented, How Immigration Became Illegal, as well as They Take Our Jobs and 20 Other Myths About Immigration, which is about to be reissued. Avi, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot for having me on the show.
So let's start with maybe before we actually go into some of the things that you discuss in Undocumented, let's start with one of those myths about immigration, that they take our jobs. Is that a myth?
Yes, that's a myth. it's a complicated myth to disentangle, but when people say immigrants take American jobs, first of all, they're assuming that there is a finite number of jobs in the United States. So you have this sort of picture of how the economy works. There's a finite number of jobs. So when you add more people, then that creates more competition for jobs. But that's not actually how the economy works at all. There's many other factors involved in the economy. There's corporate decisions about where to locate, where to close, where to reopen. And there's also the fact that population growth of any sort creates consumption as well as
labor
adding
competition,
people to the labor force, so that every person who is a producer is also a consumer and thus is creating jobs. So when the population of a place grows, that means there's more need for schools, there's more need for hospitals, there's more need for movie theaters, there's more need for everything that the people there use. When the population decreases, then businesses have to close because there's nobody to buy what they're producing. So what we have seen is revitalization of many areas because of immigration. That means that places that were dying neighborhoods and cities are now being revitalized through immigration. So there's many, many different things that go into how many jobs you're going to find in one particular place. But it's certainly completely erroneous to assume that an increasing population is going to decrease the number of jobs.
And all right, so let's turn to the topics that you cover in Undocumented, how immigration became illegal. I know that you've said in the past that we're a nation of immigrants is somewhat misleading. What do you mean by that?
Yes, I always have a problem with that concept of saying that we're a nation of immigrants. Because I think it's a very distorted and partial look at our history, and I would even say it's a kind of a white supremacist view of our history. And this is the reason why. Bear with me, because it's a little bit complicated.
That's what we're here for.
So the United States is a white settler colonial society, right? It was based on the principle of European immigrants coming and displacing and replacing the indigenous population. We share that characteristic with some other countries of the world, especially Canada, Australia, New Zealand, all of these white settler colonial societies that were founded by Europeans who came not to rule over the existing population, as other colonial European projects have done, say the British in India or the French in Africa, but rather to eliminate the native population and replace them with a white settler colonial society. So white settler colonial societies are certainly based on immigration. They love immigration. They do everything they can to bring more white people in order to eliminate the existing native population and replace the existing native population. So it's true in that respect that we're a country of immigrants, but it's nothing to be proud of. The other thing is that most of these white settler colonial societies also brought in people who were not white, but who were not immigrants, that is, in the United States, through the forced transportation of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Africans. Okay? They were not considered immigrants. They were not eligible for citizenship. Right. They were not part of the new country. They were deliberately excluded during the colonial period and also after the country of the United States was founded. So once again, people who are not white are here, but they are not part of the country. So again, when you say we are a country of immigrants, you're basically saying we're a country that was founded on white supremacy.
Good.
So it's true, but it's not something to be proud of. It's very problematic, and we should be honest about what it means. Now, anti-immigrant, the United States, for the first 100 years until the Civil War, was strongly promoting white immigration because its project was to build a white country and to populate the land with white people. So there was a huge promotion of immigration. Immigrants were the privileged classes because they were European, they were white, and anybody who came who was not European and white was not considered an immigrant because they were not eligible for citizenship, because the first naturalization law passed in 1790 established that only white people could be citizens, thus only of all the different people from different parts of the world who were entering U.S. territory forcibly or voluntarily, only those who were white were considered immigrants and were eligible for citizenship.
So in many respects, at least in terms of, I guess, the etymology of that word in the context of the United States of America, is that when we say immigrant, we are, if not explicitly, at least implicitly saying white people who moved to this country.
At least until the 20th century, yes. Or pretty much, yes.
And so, which is not to say that there wasn't some type of, I guess, hierarchy within the context of I guess what we would call white people. I mean, there's
what we would today call white people.
Right. All right. I mean, so like there were certain white people who were a little bit less white than other white people in the context of immigration.
Yes, but according to U.S. naturalization law, all Europeans were defined as white. So it's totally true that there was discrimination, that there was marginalization, that there was oppression, that there was exploitation against Irish, against Italians, against Polish immigrants, but they were white by law.
So, all right, so that takes us up to the beginning of the 20th century, I guess. I mean, what point does this start to change?
Well, one big turning point is the Civil War. And after the Civil War, the establishment of the 14th Amendment, which creates a new kind of citizenship, not citizenship by race. Until 1868, citizenship, there was only one qualification for citizenship, and that was race. Nothing else mattered. It didn't matter if you were born here or if you were an immigrant. If you were white, you were a citizen. If you were not white, you were not a citizen. 1868, the 14th Amendment creates a new kind of citizenship, citizenship by birth. The idea that anyone who is born in the territory is automatically a citizen, regardless of their race. So citizenship is opened up racially. And shortly after that, in 1870, a new naturalization law is also passed, expanding naturalization, which up until then was available only to white people, expanding naturalization to persons of African nativity and African descent. That is, black people were now eligible for citizenship. And obviously, these two laws were passed as a repudiation of slavery and as an acknowledgement of the wrongs that had been done to black people in this country. However, nobody else could naturalize. That meant that Chinese could not naturalize, Japanese could not naturalize, Indians could not naturalize, Mexicans could not naturalize. Only Europeans and people of African descent could naturalize after 1870. But there were no people from Africa coming to the United States after 1870. So the United States is seeing large immigration from Europe. It's seeing large immigration from Asia. It's seeing large immigration from Mexico. And still, only the immigrants from Europe are allowed to naturalize.
And so, I'm sorry, go ahead. Well, I just wanted to say, just point out, so we're looking at the motivation behind that change, obviously in the 14th Amendment, but also just sort of from a statutory standpoint, was strictly one that was born out of Reconstruction and a function of the Union essentially edifying its dominance in the Civil War. It was not some type of broader enlightenment or desire for some type of different immigration policy. It was really more of a function of, we will keep the same open door policy for white people, but we also need to deal with the vestige of the pre-Civil War era, and that we will do through these laws.
Absolutely, exactly. And we see the contradiction coming out. That is, there's a contradiction between citizenship by birth and the naturalization law that still excludes many people from access to citizenship. Because what happens if a Chinese person gives birth in the United States? That baby is racially ineligible to citizenship, but it's a citizen by virtue of being born in the United States. So immediately after recognizing this contradiction, Congress starts passing racially exclusive immigration laws, because now citizenship can't be restricted on the basis of race because we have citizenship by birth. So this is when immigration starts being seen as a threat. And this is when, as a racial threat to the white country. So any group of immigrants that is coming to the country that is not white is racially excluded one by one until by 1917, about two-thirds of the world's territory is forbidden from immigration into the United States. It's called the Asiatic Barred Zone. But there's one exception here, which responds to a different need. That is, there is, especially in the U.S. Southwest and California, a huge need for Mexican workers, especially after Chinese and other Asian immigration is halted. So Mexicans are treated differently under these restrictive, racially restrictive immigration laws that are passed at the beginning of the 20th century. There are no restrictions placed on Mexican entry into the country. However, they are not considered immigrants. They are considered deportable workers. So there
Let me stop you there, because I want to just go back up one second. So when these racially restrictive laws were written, and one by one, these various groups are prevented from naturalizing, but also from coming to have a, to becoming citizens. How explicit was it by race, or was it done in the context of what Donald Trump tried to do a little bit last year, and to some extent was successful? Was it done by nation of origin? Was there any even attempt to put a fig leaf on this? Was there any other type of rationale?
Really. No. That is, naturalization was restricted by race openly. It was open only to white people and people of African descent.
Okay, fair enough. And so,
So anybody who did not belong to those two categories was considered racially ineligible to citizenship. That was the terminology that was used.
That's pretty explicit.
So the restrictions were based on, were put into law on the basis of nation, but with the automatic assumption that nation and race went together. That is, an immigrant from China was Chinese. And if there was a citizen of China who was not Chinese, then they were, who was white, for example, then the racial restriction did not apply to them.
All right. And so they, and then the response in terms of Mexicans was, you are essentially guest workers who are deportable at any time. That's basically right. The I mean, that was the status, is that you're legal, but you're also, we can get rid of you at any time. I mean, so what, I mean, make that distinction as opposed to your, I mean, are they breaking the law when they enter, or are they just simply a status of which you are removable?
It varied a lot over time, and it continues to evolve, this
right.
deportability of Mexicans. It's written into law differently at different times. For example, the two Bracero programs, 1917 till the early 1920s, and then again from 1942 to 1964. Those were explicit deportability programs, that is, contract workers contracted in Mexico, brought to the United States, and then expelled when their contracts ended. There were mass deportations in the 1930s and again in the 1950s of Mexicans based on their Mexicanness. There was the vague notion of likely to become a public charge, LTC, which could be applied to anybody to refuse their entry into the United States. But in general, entry was open from Mexico. But once in the United States, under one pretext or another, Mexicans were funneled into this category of deportability. And it did change over time, the legal rationales. Really, it wasn't until after 1965 that illegality per se, rather than racial Mexicanness, became the primary rationale for the deportability of Mexicans. And this was done in the 1965 revisions of the immigration law, the Hart-Celler Immigration Nationality Act of 1965, which put numerical limits on Mexican migration for the first time. Up until this time, hundreds of thousands of Mexicans are crossing the border with no limits, nobody trying to stop them, but in this category of deportable on the basis of Mexicanness. After 1965, a limit of 20,000 per year is put on Mexican migration into the United States. And this turns, there's still, it's really easy to cross the border, but now there's the rationale of illegality, which grows and grows like a cancer after 1965 until it's turned into today something that people go around, white people go around saying, don't you know what illegal means?
Right. Well, all right.
As if it were obvious.
All right. Well, let's. I want to back up and just sort of just be clear. So you had situations where, throughout this pre 1965 passage of Immigration Nationality Act, where you had, and presumably, right, I would imagine it's like agricultural conglomerates or maybe temp work agencies for agricultural, largely, I would imagine, agricultural outfits, going down to Mexico, recruiting people. And how much of, I mean, what was the justification? What was the incentive structure behind this? I mean, the first thing that occurs to me is that, well, if I'm one of these companies, there's value in me having to go down and pick up these Mexican workers. But if I can offload the costs of sending them back home to the government via deportation, that's good. And I also can sort of maintain a slack in the workforce, but understand that the government may have political pressures. I mean, what was What was the theory about that legal status, where you can come in, but if we decide we want to kick you out, we have a legal process in which to do that? What was the sort of the rationale behind that, or what was it attempting to what I guess, you know, I would guess capitalist problem was it attempting to solve?
A couple of different things. First of all, in the first half of the century, it was not primarily agricultural. A lot of Mexican workers were brought to work on the railroad,
right.
Railroad building, and a lot were brought to work in mining. So the overwhelmingly agricultural use of Mexican migrant workers starts with the Bracero program in the 1940s. So by the second half of the 20th century, yes, you're right that agriculture is the primary place that Mexican workers are going. Of course, in the late 20th century, this starts to shift again after the 1980s, and Mexicans are moving out of California, out of the Southwest. Some are still staying in agriculture, so you find a lot of Mexicans working in agriculture in the Northeast, in the Southeast of the U.S., and they're also moving into other sectors of the growing service, lower levels of the service economy throughout the country. The rationale is almost pathetically obvious, and I'll look at two different sides of it, which are both really related to, like, I mean, you said it, it's profit, capitalism. One is that when workers are deportable, it's a lot harder for them to organize for their rights. If you're here on a contract, your contract depends on you staying with your employer. You cannot leave your employer. You're basically an indentured worker. So if you protest, your employer lets you go and you're deported. So it's a disincentive to labor rights. The second rationale from a capitalist perspective, you have to kind of zoom out to see this, but in the industrialized world in the 20th century, especially through the New Deal, there was a shift to forcing employers, corporations, to shoulder some of the costs of the reproduction of the labor force. That is, employers had to pay taxes that would go towards supporting workers if they became disabled. They had to pay wages that were sufficient for a worker to support a family. They had to pay taxes that went to the schooling of the next generation of workers. So the creation of a social welfare state through the policies of the New Deal put burdens on corporations to give back towards the reproduction of the labor force.
Yes.
Is that clear? Okay.
Yes.
That's expensive. But if you can push the reproduction of the labor force into the third world and have a steady supply of prime working age, strong young men available to you without having to invest anything in right. the reproduction of this labor force, let the third world countries reproduce them for you, you get to reap the benefits of this reproduction without having to contribute to it. So this works out very well for employers. And you see this debate going on during the period of slavery, where slaveholders debate, do we actually want to have to contribute to the reproduction of our enslaved labor force? Isn't it cheaper just to bring in new ones from Africa? And when the slave trade winds down is when employers start to be forced to enable the reproduction of their labor force, which means that it becomes more expensive to them.
Interesting. And so all right, so moving back up in time to the passage of the Immigration Nationality Act, it puts a numerical limit on Mexican migration. What is the impetus for that change? And B, what does it say about does the limits on immigration change for any other group at that time?
Yes. So the 1965 law got rid of all of the racial restrictions on immigration. And the impetus is, think about it, we're in the post-World War II period. We're in the period of decolonization. We're in the period of a generalized repudiation of overt racism, of colonialism. We're trying to promote, we're in the midst of the Cold War. We're trying to promote the United States as a country that grants equal rights to everybody. We're in the height of the civil rights movement. So getting rid of the racial restrictions on immigration and treating every country equally is part of the rationale behind the 1965 law.
That's interesting.
So all of the racial restrictions are removed. Every single country in the world gets the same quota in 1965, 20,000 per year.
And this is, I mean, this is both a function of what's happening domestically in terms of race, but it's also a function in some ways of the Cold War. And we're trying to project a more egalitarian, more third world friendly, maybe image with the rest of the world. It's interesting that that's come up just because we did an interview last week where it was largely about one element of the Cold War, and that being one of them. So we make this change, and the unintended consequence or intended consequence is this concept of illegality that is then born. Like, this is the first time we start talking about illegal immigrants.
Well, it's the first time that illegal immigration becomes Mexicanized. That is, the Border Patrol was created in 1924 to patrol the U.S.-Mexican border, but not to stop Mexicans from crossing the border, to stop Chinese from illegally entering the country from Mexico.
Interesting.
So the creation of illegality as characteristic of Mexicans, of the vast majority of Mexicans in the United States, this association of Mexicans with illegality and the use of illegality as the rationale for the deportation of Mexicans, I would say, is very much due to the 1965 law.
And so the next big change in immigration law happens in 1986. This is the Immigration Reform and Control Act. What happens in the interim that Immigration Reform and Control Act, which sounds pretty ominous, what happens during that 20 some odd year period, and what does the IRCA intend to fix, supposedly?
Can I take one little detour before I get to that?
Please.
Do I have time?
Yes.
So one other thing that the 1965, and I will try to remember to get back to your question when I finish with my detour. One other thing that the 1965 immigration law did that is very significant and is being talked about constantly now is that it prioritized family reunification. So those 20,000 per year were allotted out primarily on the basis of U.S. citizens petitioning for their relatives. And this is known as family reunification visas. So this meant a couple of different things. One, it meant that if you did not have relatives in the United States, you basically had no chance of coming here. And it meant, too, that, 20,000 per year meant that every country was, in theory, treated equally, but in fact, not treated very equally. Because if you think about it, some parts of the world, one part of the world in particular, is made up of a lot of very small countries from which there was practically no demand to come to the United States during that time.
Right.
Countries like Luxembourg and Switzerland and Belgium and Denmark, like the white countries. other parts of the world, like China, Indonesia, India, the Philippines, huge countries with hundreds of millions of population, get that same 20,000 a year. So it means that if you're a European and you want to immigrate to the United States, you pretty much can just do it. Whereas if you're a Mexican or a Chinese or a Filipino, you have to wait many, many decades to get access to one of those 20,000 a year, even if you're lucky enough to have those family members who are going to petition for you and be able to use the family reunification. So just one more thing about family reunification before I get to IRCA, which is that a couple of weeks ago, President Trump started denouncing family reunification, and he denounced it using the terminology of chain migration. Now, chain migration is a term that historians and sociologists have used since the 1960s to try to understand historical patterns of migration and the fact that migrants tend to go to places where they know people. So you find things like towns in Massachusetts where villages from Italy sent dozens of people to the same little town in Massachusetts because the pioneers, the first Italian people from that Italian village to go there, then wrote back home. They said, there's jobs here. Send your cousin, send your uncle. So chain migration is something that is a term that we've used to describe migration patterns from all over the world over many, many decades. All of a sudden, President Trump uses chain migration as if it's an epithet. Like, we have to end this chain migration. Well, he's talking about trying to transform human history. But what he's really talking about is the family reunification visas. He wants to eliminate the family reunification visas. So I just wanted to kind of clarify that, because all of a sudden everyone's acting like, oh, chain migration, is that a bad thing? It's a thing.
But it's actually not. It's really more of a description of patterns. It's not a policy. The policy is family reunification. And while we're here, I will remember that other question. But while we're here, one or two more questions about this. One thing to also be clear, that family reunification is not just a ticket. It's restrictive in the sense that you need to have someone here who is basically going to be your fiscal sponsor and is going to guarantee that you will not become a draw on this
LPC.
Right. And so you will not become that. The idea of family reunification is both, arguably being humane, but it's also basically saying, hey, you are not a ward of the state. You are a ward of this family, and there's some citizens here who will have liability for you.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I just wanted to make that clear, because I think there's just a tremendous amount of misunderstanding about that. And I would also ask too, is it the case? I mean, I get the idea that, like, you know, you have I don't know how many countries in Europe off the top of my head, but they are the percentage that 20,000 represents for those various countries in Europe is a lot less than it would represent for, let's say, China. But also, I would imagine in 1965, there wasn't necessarily, or maybe this isn't true, if we have a history up to that point of essentially keeping people out by race, then there isn't necessarily that many people to come forward and say, I'm going to sponsor relatives of mine. Is there or no?
The family reunification was a priority system. So if the priority categories were filled, then you go down the priority list in terms of who is eligible to get a visa.
So theoretically, we could have a country where there's just Eritrea. I don't know why I'm choosing Eritrea, but I am. That there is just not a lot of Eritreans in the country in 1965.
Eritrea didn't exist yet in 1965.
There you have it. But the point being that there's not there's not a lot of family reunification, so that 20,000 could be filled by new immigrants, essentially.
Yeah.
We have no...
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Just wanted to be clear on that. So let's jump forward between that period from 1965 to 1986, the passage of the Immigration Nationality Act. What does that purport to fix?
Okay, so what's happening in those years between 1965 and 1986 is a huge increase in illegal immigration from Mexico, because suddenly immigration from Mexico has been illegalized. Increasing anti-illegal immigrant propaganda, exploitation of Mexican workers on the basis of illegality, and the beginnings of large-scale migration from other parts of Latin America, due in large part to U.S. policies. That is, for example, after the military coup that overthrew President Allende in Chile in 1973, we have an outflow of refugees from Chile, and many of them come to the United States. After the U.S. invasion of the Dominican Republic in 1965, we start seeing large-scale Dominican migration into the United States. After the Cuban Revolution in 1959, the United States starts fostering and sponsoring large-scale Cuban migration to the United States. And Cubans, by the way, are exempted from that 20,000 a year. They're automatically granted refugee status. With the wars increasing in Central America, we start seeing outflows of refugees from Central America. So the Latin American population of the United States is diversifying. It's moving beyond California, and as anti-illegal sentiment is growing, the idea that we have to create more repression against undocumented immigrants, including the militarization of the border, is also growing. So IRCA is what is talked about today. Today we're talking about it as some kind of a compromise. We used to call it a comprehensive immigration reform. But it was a purported attempt to get rid of the problem of illegality by granting a path to citizenship to some of the people who were in the United States undocumented at the time, deporting the rest, making life increasingly miserable for and deporting those who were not eligible to adjust their status, and militarizing the border. Now, this sounds suspiciously like what's going to start being debated in Congress tonight, right?
Right.
It sounds suspiciously like every comprehensive immigration reform proposal. We'll grant some people the right to stay. We will increase repression against the rest, and we will further militarize the border. The 1986 law did grant status to significant numbers of people, and in that respect, it helped a lot of people, but it also, for the first time, created employer sanctions. That is, it made it illegal to work if you did not have explicit permission to work in the United States, which greatly increased the power of employers to exploit their workers. And it began the trend of border militarization, which has made it much more expensive and difficult and dangerous and frequently deadly for people to try to cross the border. And interestingly, an unexpected result of the 1986 law that supposedly was aimed at getting rid of undocumentedness was to greatly increase the number of undocumented people in the United States. And numerous studies now have shown us why that is the case. That is, as it became more and more dangerous and expensive and difficult and deadly to cross the border,
People didn't go back.
So a 150-year-long history of circular migration turned into a one-way stream. It's not that more people were coming, but once people were here, they were afraid to go back because they thought they would never get in again. And this also means that people start bringing their families. So what had previously been primarily young single men of working age became a much more diverse migrant stream.
And
so this is how the population, the undocumented population, just mushroomed between 1986 and really 2007, which was when it reached the peak. Now it started to go down again.
And we should say, before we get to 2007, just in terms of what the sort of like ancillary impact of that is, obviously during that time we had NAFTA, which made it that much more difficult for people, workers working in agriculture in Mexico. They came to the cities, and the jobs weren't there, and so they came north. How much also did the lack of fluidity add to the growing violence in some of these countries? Because I imagine if the money that was available to the broad population then becomes sort of sequestered, right? It's only available to those who cross the border and stay in the United States. So for people who may have been involved in circular migration, bringing the money back and then going out, and that was their job, they have to find work in countries where there may not be as many opportunities. And I wonder how much that fed into the drug trade.
Well, I should say that remittances, it's not really true that people who are in Mexico or in El Salvador don't have access to what's earned in the United States, because many, many, many people who are working here are sending home remittances.
Right.
So, in fact, the economies of some of these small countries are very, very dependent on the remittances that are sent back from the U.S. But certainly, the militarization of the border contributed greatly to the increasing, to turning smuggling from a sort of a small smuggling of people across the border, that is the coyote business, from a sort of a small-scale artisanal business into a hugely lucrative source of income that was increasingly taken over by gangs and drug traffickers. So this big business of drug trafficking on the border is in many ways a very direct result of the militarization of the border. And we can predict that the more we militarize it, the more that is going to increase.
So now that we have a net basically wash when it comes to immigration from, at the very least, from Mexico, what is behind that? Is there, have we reached some type of equilibrium? Has it, is there, what is driving that dynamic?
So yes, Mexican migration has reached net zero. And in fact, the number of undocumented people in the United States has declined from about 12 million to about 11 million, mostly because of the departure of Mexicans. And there's a number of different reasons for that. That doesn't mean, though, that people are not still crossing the border. They are. It's still mostly Mexicans who are crossing the border, even though the numbers of Mexicans are declining and the numbers of Central Americans are increasing. But Mexico is so much larger than the Central American countries, so Mexicans still account for the majority of people crossing the border. A number of different things that sociologists are looking at in terms of why the economic downturn in the United States, that is, Mexicans were primarily coming for economic reasons, whereas Central Americans are primarily coming to escape violence. So the economic downturn in the United States contributes to Mexicans deciding it's better to stay home, but Central Americans don't have that choice. Decreasing birth rate in Mexico, improvements in Mexico's economy, so increasing number of jobs in Mexico. There's a number of different factors. We're still sort of parsing this out because it's something that's in the process of happening, but clearly the numbers, overall numbers, have gone down, but the numbers of Central Americans are still increasing.
So okay, so let's jump forward to more or less where we are now. You wrote Undocumented, I think it was in 2014, if not mistaken, mm-hmm. 2015, and which was during, if not specifically that year, but during an era where the number of deportations, I think, was getting record-breaking by the Obama administration, ostensibly to develop some credibility to get to some so-called comprehensive immigration reform deal, which never materialized. At the end of the Obama administration, the DACA policy was implemented. We are now about to see that being unwound, you know, to the extent that it already hasn't been unwound in terms of people eligible for DACA and more feeling like they are in a very tenuous situation. What, from your perspective, before we get to solutions, what is the Trump administration trying to do here? They have doubled the amount of arrests. They can't increase in a significant way the number of deportations because the system is at capacity. So we just have this backlog of people who are losing their ability to work or they're being detained, imprisoned. What is the Trump administration, from your perspective, what are they trying to do?
That's a really good question. So major economic sectors in the United States do not support these immigration policies. Certainly the agricultural lobby does not support these policies. The building trades do not support these policies. So Trump is pursuing a set of policies that is appealing to certain sectors of his base, nativists, people who just don't like immigrants. It's irrational, it's racist, but there are people cheering when he does this. Now, how important are those people to Trump? Does he just like to be cheered? That is, with some of Trump's major policy initiatives, say the tax bill or the attempt to overturn Obamacare, you can see which economic sectors are behind this, who's benefiting from it.
Right.
It's really clear. With the immigration policy, it's not so clear. But another thing that I think we see happening is that Trump is really going after the low-hanging fruit here. That is, his ICE under Trump, yes, they have increased arrest and deportation levels, but still not to where they were during Obama's first term, for example. That is, all of the news articles are comparing 2017 to 2016. Well, 2016 was the lowest year in terms of Obama's arrest and deportation levels. So if we go back a little further, we see that that Trump hasn't really raised them that much compared to what they were early in Obama's term. But when I say he's going after low-hanging fruit, many of the people we're seeing being deported now are people who were in the system but who had been granted, say, a stay of removal under the Obama administration, who were not considered priorities for deportation. And now we hear ICE saying again and again, there are no protected categories who are exempted
right.
from deportation. He's talking about doing away with TPS. He's talking about doing away with DACA. Who is he appealing to here? Well, DACA seems to have really widespread popular support. DACA is a really confusing and interesting piece of immigration policy because immigration policies have been framed by labor needs and the need to have a racially defined exploitable labor force. Well, DACA kids don't fit that. So they don't fit the narrative that a lot of people hold in their mind about immigrant workers. They don't fit the long history of immigration being treated as something to be tweaked for labor needs, for the needs of employers. So is Trump going after DACA? Why? I don't know. I can't get inside Trump's head, but right. I have to say that his shifting agenda on immigration is less easy to understand in economic terms than have right. many of his other policy initiatives been.
Right. I mean, we can't know enough about what's going on in his mind to know that it's just sheer sadism. But it sure looks sadistic on mm-hmm. some level. And it's interesting because on one hand, one would presume like I've heard, 1.6, let's say, million people who, could be eligible for a form of DACA based upon what the eligibility requirements, but the idea that these are people who have come to this country when they were children and whatever age they are now, presumably those who are working age, they have a dubious Social Security if they've entered into the system. If they haven't, then they have no Social Security card. Yet they have probably they're certainly more acclimated to American society because they probably identify as American citizens. I mean, they've been living here for the vast majority of their lives, almost definitionally. They seem to be very ripe to me to be exploited, although they may be more savvy about what their rights or their opportunities to have people, advocate for them. So maybe they're not in that regard. But okay, so Trump's policies are a mystery. What, assuming that we got to a place where Donald Trump was not our president, because I would guess that he would not be interested in your solutions, with all due respect to all of us involved in this conversation. But and that's probably to our that's probably a compliment. But what are the solutions, and what is the problem? Because I'm not clear on what the problem is.
So I feel like immigrant rights advocates and organizations have allowed ourselves to be pushed into a corner where we're begging for scraps rather than looking at the big picture. And I understand why that's happened, but I don't think we're going to find the solutions by begging for scraps. I feel like the Democrats have been forced into this position, or maybe they want to be in this position. I don't know. They're pretty powerful people, so I don't really see them being forced into much. But have adopted this position. I'm talking about the leadership of the right. Democratic Party here, not every Democrat on the street, that they're going to fight for DACA and nothing else, that they'll give up everything else just for DACA. Well, that is a really problematic position. That is, I think if we concede that there are good immigrants and bad immigrants, and we want to do something for the good immigrants and criminalize the bad immigrants, we've right. lost before we've started.
Right. These people came in under no fault of their own, which implies immediately that, well, somebody's at fault.
Somebody.
And that's their parents
fault,
or
yeah.
whoever it is. Right.
So, I think that we need to start from a basic position of human rights, and mobility is a human right. People have the right to migrate, and people have the right to have rights wherever they are. I think we need to rethink what we mean by borders, by sovereignty, by countries, by citizenship, and we need to expand our notion of who can we discriminate against. Our laws have always not only allowed, but provided for discrimination against certain groups of people. And when we have eliminated one form of discrimination, then we say, okay, so now we don't like discrimination, but we continue to discriminate against other people, groups of people, legally discriminate against other groups of people. So I think really we need to take a much more expansive view of human rights, including the right to migrate and the rights of people to have rights wherever they are. And we need to challenge some of the ways we've been taught to think about borders and sovereignty and what it means to be a citizen. So I don't think there's any political candidate out there who's thinking along those lines, but I think that's what we need to fight for.
What is there an argument to your call to reevaluate the way that we perceive immigration? Is there an argument that that you are in any way, maybe not even persuaded of, but do you think is even in good faith that this is problematic for the country on economic grounds? I mean, let's not entertain cultural grounds. That seems, the white nature of the country. I get that. I don't subscribe to that notion. But is there any argument that you've heard out there that is in any way you find to be reasonable in terms of, like, we can't just let the borders open because we will, our social safety net will be in tatters, or we will, you know, we'll run out of resources or whatever it is. Is there any argument out there that you find at least even is like a good faith argument?
I don't agree with this argument, and I'll tell you why, but I will bring up one argument that is frequently brought up, which is that increasing the population of low-skilled workers puts U.S. citizen low-skilled workers at a disadvantage in the labor market. We could rephrase that and saying increasing the population of low-skilled workers increases the vulnerability of all unskilled workers, low-skilled workers, in the labor market. First of all, of course, there's the question of skill and what skill means, because many jobs that are actually defined as low-skilled jobs actually require a lot of skill.
Right.
And you or I might find them very difficult to do, even though I have a PhD, therefore I supposedly have a high level of skill, but I don't necessarily have the skills to do some of the jobs that have been defined as low-skilled jobs. But the other thing is that we simply can't look at immigration in isolation. That is, immigration happens in a social, political context. So we have laws, we have policies that make certain jobs low-paying. We have laws and policies that make certain populations vulnerable. So that's where we need to look. Rather than saying that the one factor that creates more vulnerability for low-income workers is immigration, is to look at the big picture. What are the factors that create low-income jobs, that create low-income workers, that produce inequality in our society? And immigration is not up there among the main factors that produce this. It's our laws and our policies that produce it. And I would also say that we live in a world of great global inequality, and that our laws and policies and military interventions have played a big role in producing and maintaining this global inequality. And when that global inequality affects low-income workers in the United States also, and that's something else we need to look at. So I would really emphasize that we need to look at policy overall rather than isolating immigration and saying this is the one factor that is changing everything.
Avi Chomsky, the book is Undocumented, How Immigration Became Illegal, and your They Take Our Jobs and 20 Other Myths About Immigration will be reissued shortly. We will link to both of those at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. Really can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome. Great to talk to you.